I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's show is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, sharing nothing but the best in whole grain nutrition and committed to their mission of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world, but there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from: a curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guests today are Brandon Dawn and Brian Pollen, co-owners of Brooklyn Kura, the very first Japanese sake brewery in New York, which opened this fall. Now that sushi and ramen are part of American diet, people are becoming even more familiar with Japanese sake. And I started to hear that passionate American lovers started to open, sake lovers started to open premium artisanal sake breweries throughout the country, including Brandon and Brian. So today we'll discuss why Brandon and Brian decided to open a sake brewery in New York, what types of sake they make, and challenges opening a sake brewery in New York, and much, much more. But before we start, Japanese is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes and Stitcher as a podcast. Please go to iTunes and Stitcher and subscribe to Japanese and write a review. We'd appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. And you can email us at japaneseats@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatayama.com. Now let's start our conversation with Brandon Dawn and Brian Pollen. Hello, Brian. Hello, Brandon. Welcome to Japanese.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Okay, so this is exciting. The first sake brewery in New York City. So before everything else, where are you from and what's your background?
I'm from Southern California.
This is Brian, by the way.
This is Brian. Yeah. Went to school in Southern California, Michigan. And my last job or life was as a product and technology leader at American Express.
Mm. very different.
Yeah.
What about you, Ben?
I moved here a year and a half ago from Portland, Oregon. I did my part to stem the tide of Brooklynites moving to Portland. I come out of research science. I'm a biochemist. And so I helped develop drugs for cancer and heart disease.
Super different.
Yeah.
Right. So how did you guys meet and came up with the idea of opening a sake brewery?
So we met at a mutual friend's wedding in Tokyo. Spent about 2 weeks traveling Japan in Kyoto, Takayama, Shirakawa-go, and in Tokyo, of course. And experienced sake for what it is in Japan for the first time and started talking about it as a product and as something we wanted to learn more about and something that we wanted to see if we could do in the U.S.
Well, that's great that, you know, if you stay in Tokyo, you can still have diverse tasting of sake. Mm-hmm. But if you travel, you find this is only available in the local region. I went to Shirakawa and Takayama too. It's I've never seen that before.
Yeah.
Right. So, but, you know, like, I'm sure the lot of listeners have been to Japan and then, oh, that's great, amazing. And they go back, let's buy more sake, but to you guys, it's next level.
So it was a long process for us. It was 2013, and we came home and we continued the conversation about it. We started to make sake in our homes, Brandon in Portland, me in Brooklyn, and then just thought more and more seriously until we were able to kind of brand it to come out here from Portland and leave our jobs and start Brooklyn Cora.
Wow. I mean, it's like a long distance relationship. Sake development is amazing how much. So, but you know, curious though that, you know, you're in Oregon and that's the land of craft beer and wine, right? But you didn't have that idea of making alcohol beverage.
Well, I'd actually been a home beer brewer since before I was 21. and I've always been fascinated with fermentation. I've made wine and even soy sauce at home.
Wow.
And then when we got introduced to sake in Japan, it's perhaps the most unusual fermentation there is in the world. Mm-hmm. So, I like to science things out, so I got really curious about it. It made sense for me to go to sake.
Right. So dear, what's the goal? There are sake breweries in this country, like a big factory based artisanal, I mentioned earlier. So what's the goal of opening your own sake brewery?
I think our goal is very simple. We want to make the best sake we can. And then we also want to introduce people, like broaden the set of consumers of sake, both ours and sake from Japan and other craft brewers across the U.S.
Interesting, because the sake market has been growing, but it's more kind of scattered around.
Yeah.
The meat borders and American-based and there's no community. Yeah. So it sounds like you're creating a sake community.
Yeah.
Right, that's great. Okay. Why did you decide to open a sake brewery in New York, not in Oregon or not somewhere else, Southern California?
Well, we discussed that. We think of New York City and Brooklyn in particular as having a very diverse set of potential consumers that are wine lovers, that are craft beer lovers, and that whole eat local, drink local culture we felt was a great place for us to do something that's a little different. And so it was easy for us after making that decision.
Right. Okay. Well, not easy for you, Brandon. We had to move across the country. But
well, I love Brooklyn so far, so it was a good move.
Right. Yeah. Well, the Oregon is, the Portland is the parent of Brooklyn, people say. Yeah. Hipsters. Right. So your car is located at the Industry City in Brooklyn. And what is Industry City and why did you decide to pick that location?
Yeah, so Industry City has been fantastic to us. There are a diverse set of maker retailers and new additions on a daily basis. It's a place that is being invested heavily in. And there's a whole network that we can leverage, whether it be Brooklyn Brine or it be other kind of members of that community. Mm-hmm. So when we were able to be introduced to the people at Industry City, find a space that works for us and our brewery, it was a very easy decision. There are activities at Industry City on a daily basis that draw people from across New York City and more broadly. Mm-hmm. There are, and we're excited to see, so Japan Village is coming to Industry City. So an Eataly-like Japan, right. Japanese marketplace, mm-hmm. the Hometown Barbecue will be there soon. So it's a place that's exciting being invested in, and it was a perfect fit for us.
Mm. So basically the newly developed business complex slash food business entertainment space. And each time I visit your place, there's a new place open.
Exactly.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. Yeah.
So. Yeah, we've met a lot of people who have been very helpful for you know, we're a new company when we need to source things. Mm. When I have questions about how to set something up, there's tons of friends that we have now. We can go ask questions and get help.
Yeah. Right. And also, I'm sure you help other people as well as the community. Great. Okay. And it's a question to Brandon. So how did you learn to make sake on top of brewing beer and other things?
Yeah, so there's some crossover with beer and wine. And I've got a lot of experience in just tending a fermentation. But I have spent a little time in Japan and studied at some breweries there in Japan and in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. So did you ask sake brewers in Japan, like, please
let me can I come get up at 5 in the morning and do a lot of sweeping for you?
Wow. Yeah. Well, how actually did you make a contact with each?
A little different. Like, we've had so many people reach out to us when they've heard about us, and a lot of excitement that we've made a lot of friends. And so people have helped give us introductions.
Nice.
So I spent a little time there, learning from, lifelong sake brewers. And then a lot of just self-teaching. Whenever I can find a textbook or something, I put a lot of things into Google Translate. I watch a lot of YouTube videos. It's just, we're the first thing I learned about brewing sake is that I'll be learning about it for the rest of my life. So we still have a lot to learn. Mm. And every day we learn something new.
Mm, that's the Toji spirit. Right. So, okay. And you also worked at the Sake One in Oregon?
Yeah, I spent a little time at Sake One, which is just right outside of Portland. It's a rather large craft sake brewery.
Mm-hmm. And it's owned by Momokawa Shuzo in Japan?
I think that's right or not.
It's not anymore?
I think it's owned by Hakatsuru.
Okay.
Which is a Japanese.
Right. Okay, so that's taken over maybe by all those things happening.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Mm. Okay. Well, it's good that the Hakatsuru is a major company.
Yes. Yeah.
And then, on the other hand, it's this craft beer and the craft sake making is happening, like you guys do. So that's very encouraging.
It is.
Right. Okay. And so the top page of your website says American craft sake inspired by tradition brewed in Brooklyn. So what's the sake making philosophy of Brooklyn craft?
So, I mean, in simple terms, we believe sake is underrepresented across tables and restaurants and markets in the U.S. And so we feel strongly that as people are introduced to sake, that they can discover like we did and make it a more regular part of their consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And so in addition to wanting to make the best sake that we possibly can, we want to continue to use our space and our sake and then other sakes that are produced across the country and in Japan to broaden the set of consumers of sake.
Right. Well, that's the availability and approachability. It's very important because I think in Japan, if you go to a convenience store in Japan, this thing costs $30 here and then it's $10. Can you believe it? Well, those are customs and things. So sake is still a little more luxurious item. But because you don't have to go through the custom part, you can probably produce sake at a more reasonable price.
And we will produce a range of costs and products. I think ultimately, because we're local and we have the facility that we do, at least for the New York City consumers, we can invite them to our new home, show them how sake is produced, and introduce them to a broader range than they would otherwise have exposure to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all in like the philosophy of making the best sake and exposing as many people to it that we can.
Right. Well, when I visit your tasting room, which is not totally open yet to the public, but you have nice kind of tap like a craft beer taps.
Yeah.
And when you pass by, you don't realize this is a serious sake brewery, which I think is a good point because now you can you feel like trying without going to Japanese restaurants.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay. And so what kind of challenges have you faced or are you facing right now in your opening and running a sake brewery?
So it's, I mean, challenges abound, right? So whether it be the regulatory environment at the federal and local and federal, state, and local levels, or be site selection, choosing a place where we can quickly and easily build. And
let me ask you that regulation issues. Yeah. What kind of problems?
So it's just a lengthy process. So the federal government treats sake differently than New York State. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, I mean, we are, I believe we are the first sake brewery in New York State. Mm-hmm. And so just their treatment of us and what kind of paperwork is necessary, what type of amendments were necessary, mm-hmm. posed some challenges.
Wait, so according to New York State, sake brewery is a winery?
So we are a commercial winery in New York State. And from a federal perspective, we're a beer brewery with some supplementals. And then, of course, sake, when it's distributed, is distributed with labels that are kind of approved by the federal government as wine labels.
Mm.
So, and then there's locally navigating the difference between agriculture and markets and Department of Health and the FDA. So from a regulatory perspective, plenty of challenges.
Right.
Finding a space in New York City that's zoned appropriately to build and operate a brewery and a tap room also has posed challenges.
Mm.
Finding the right people, actually. So hiring has posed some challenges for us. And then, I mean, Brandon, speak about...
Yeah, I mean, and from an equipment standpoint, Japanese brewers don't often want to sell anything. and when they do, when you hear of like a sake press or something that you really want, it's usually too expensive and too expensive to ship over. So we've sort of had to invent some things. We've had to source things from, I mean, we own more Italian winemaking equipment than Japanese sake equipment. Like, that's just a thing that we could get that will, you know, work. So we've had to, that's been a challenge to, you know, get everything to come together and work together.
Mm.
Our press arrived today.
Yeah, our press showed up today on a big truck.
Wow, so the press is from...
Press is from Cincinnati.
Yeah. Wow. made in the U.S.
Mm, so that's amazing, right? Yeah. And because you understand how sake is made, you can customize it. But
yeah, you just kind of if you understand the concept of how the sake is pressed, we know what sort of physical factors needed to happen. So we talked to a manufacturer and we need a steamer to steam the rice. And so I found our steamer is the one big piece of machinery that was made in Brooklyn. So I found a steel manufacturer and sat with them, with their team, and drew pictures and talked about it at length. And they produced a beautiful steamer for us.
Mm. Vinegar Hill.
Vinegar Hill, yeah.
Wow. That's very impressive. Actually, that really, that's craftsmanship already, yeah. Right, for different reason.
Yeah.
And then our general contractors did an amazing job, like just putting it together. Like, none of them have ever heard of a koji room. Or the fact that it needs to be hot and I say it has to be like Southeast Asian there. It has to be hot and humid. And so they did a great job building it to how we needed it. So we lucked out with them.
Right. Well, maybe a lot of people come up to you and just tell me, I'm going to open a second brewery. So you could be the founder of the new equipment. Right. Okay. And the main ingredients of sake are water, rice, koji. Those things. So where do you get them?
So we're using American ingredients. We get rice right now from both California and Arkansas. There's a couple kinds of sake mai, or rice that's specific for sake, grown in Arkansas. So right now we're sourcing it from there in California, and then we're just constantly looking for anybody else that, we'll take rice. If it makes great sake, we'll get it from anywhere.
Mm.
We make our own koji in our koji room. And so to do that, we need koji tane or koji kin. Mm.
So let me ask, for listeners who are not familiar with koji, what is koji?
So koji is a certain portion of the steam rice goes into the koji room. And we grow a fungus on it called Aspergillus oryzae. And the reason for doing that, and like what I was saying earlier about how bizarre sake brewing process is there's yeast, but the yeast needs sugar to produce CO2 and alcohol. Mm-hmm. Since the rice is milled away, there's no way to malt it like you would with beer. So the koji grows on the rice and produces the enzymes, amylase specifically, needed to sort of leak out of the koji and dissolve the rice and slowly provide the sugar for the yeast over the month-long fermentation.
Right. So in other words, koji converts starch to sugar,
exactly.
And the sugar is converted by the yeast to
It's called alcohol. Multiple parallel fermentation.
Mm. So that's the beer is like one at a time.
Yeah. So you know, in wine, all the sugar that the yeast is going to eat is already in the grape.
Mm.
In beer, the first process of making beer is you mash the grains because there's enzymes already in there, and then you heat it up in the mash tun, and that turns the starches in like an hour or so into sugar.
Mm. So then the beer is another step. That step to convert sugar to alcohol, but it's everything happens in the same time, at the same time in the same place. That's why the sake brewing is so complex and
and the idea that they figured this out like over 1,000 years ago is pretty mind blowing too.
Right. Okay. And again, you know, the sake is so regional that. You said, you know, the rice comes from Arkansas and California, but I think the idea of using sake rice, it depends on which region you go. So it makes sense that you have Arkansas rice and California rice, right? So, and I heard you use Yamada Nishiki, which is a super premium sake mine, to grow koji.
Yeah, there's we have a relationship with a farmer in Arkansas who grows that, and... And hopefully the next couple of years he's gonna add to his list of different sake mines.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's no reason, right? It's a good climate. They should be able to grow good sake rice.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And so do you see the quality as par, as good as
Japanese? I mean, I think another thing I didn't mention is we use Brooklyn water. So I moved here from Portland, Oregon, which has pristine water, and I've never lived on the East Coast. So I thought, I'm moving to the biggest city in the East Coast, in the United States, and I just assumed the water would need to be treated heavily. But I came to learn that Brooklyn has famous water. You know, it's famous for bagels, for pizza, and we hope for sake, too. It's a little on the soft side. The yeast really seems to love it. When it comes into our brewery, just because of the old pipe infrastructure, I have one filter to move a little bit of iron, and then I remove the chlorine that the city puts into it. But other than that, we keep Brooklyn water the same.
I think New York City water is voted for number one in the whole country, so that makes sense. Okay, and I think Oregon water tends to be slightly salty. Is that what it is?
It varies. Like right in Portland, it's actually very, very soft. It's almost distilled water.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Right. So we have to maneuver all those different things. Okay. And so in terms of Kobo, which is yeast, I heard the Birth of Sake, the film, that the Tedorigawa Brewery, that Yoshida-san gave you some Kobo as well.
Yeah. He visited us. The Toji from Tedorigawa visited, and we knew ahead of time that he was coming. So we arranged to. Get the strain of yeast that he uses. And so we brewed with his yeast with American ingredients and served it to him when he showed up.
So that's very fascinating. How do you think, I mean, is it really different from what you expect with American ingredients? And you never know what happens.
I mean, responses have varied. We've had like sort of master Japanese sake tasters come and not believe that like this was American rice, you know, they had trouble believing that, and I think the American palate is different too, so some of the rices we use can give a heavier taste, which might not be as popular in Japan for a sake, but people like different things, and so we're trying to produce a range with the ingredients that we have.
Right. Well, that's the point of having a terroir.
Yep, exactly.
Right. So, I can't wait. You're going to develop all those different types of rice. And by the way, you use kalos rice?
Yeah, kalos.
Which is not for sakamai.
I think it's actually...
Descendant. So we've heard that it is descendant. I mean, I think one thing that I'd say is there's a large... amount of infrastructure supporting sake production in California because the four large breweries like the Tokara, Gaikakan, Yagaki are there. And so for us as a fledgling business, the fact that there's rice that they've tested and kind of gone through the process of making sake for the last 25 years with and kind of worked with farmers to refine to make it more comparable or substitutable for sake mai has made our life easier. And so we've made delicious sakes with CalRose. And we've made the decision to augment the CalRose with Yamada Nishiki because we think it makes the final product even better.
Right. I actually went to Gekkan America's page, and they really try to adjust themselves to use CalRose rice, and it is like you said, it's a good history. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a very interesting, you know, American sake history. So okay, and so what types of sake do you make?
So we are going to launch with Junmai sake, essentially four ingredients: water, koji, rice, and yeast. And our first styles will be ginjo grade. So the rice will be milled to more than 60%, both our California rice and our rice from Arkansas. And we will launch one of our things that we think is a unique offering to the New York City community and something we're excited about, an unpasteurized sake, a nama sake. We will also launch pasteurized sake that's pasteurized once in bottle and we'll be able to have shelf life outside of the refrigerator.
But it's instead of twice, it's only once. It's called the nama chozo. Right. And also, you said a junmai. That means no added alcohol.
Exactly.
So it sounds like your style is more kind of freshness, emphasize-oriented
style
of sake.
Exactly. And then we hope to, we've gotten a lot of requests already, and we've made a few in the past, but for a nigori sake to add to that. And then we have the tap room. So the tap room essentially is a place for us to experiment, to get customer feedback real time, and kind of evolve our recipes and offerings over the course of the coming years.
Well, that's great, because also nigori is filtered. That means more of the original taste. So nama and nigori.
Exactly.
So it's really New York terroir. That's great. But when are you launching?
So we are brewing today. I mean, essentially, so we are expecting to open the tap room for very limited hours to the public in early January. We are starting to put some plans together around events to invite the New York City community out to the space. But we are being very measured. It's important that in our first scale production and packaging that we take whatever time we need to do it right. We've had such tremendous support and there's a lot of enthusiasm in the sake community for us to open. We had an event on November 21st, our first event with Nambu Bijin. And it kind of is so we're trying to achieve in that space a center point for the New York City sake community. And it's not just about our sake, it's about celebrating Nihonshu and the sake that's brought here and then other local craft brewers. And
fantastic.
So we did that. It was great.
Right. I mean, Nambu Bijin is one of the biggest labels, including here in New York City. And they win all those prizes. And Kuji-san, he's an amazing president. And he had American apprentice, Ben Bell.
Exactly. Right?
So I'm hoping to have him sometime soon in the near future.
Oh, amazing.
But yeah, so it's great. And like, you know, this global movement, Nambu Bijin initiating on Japanese side and you guys are doing. So I can't wait to see some, maybe in 3 years, 5 years, something new is going to be happening here.
Let's hope. I think so, right.
Okay, so let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about how traditional sake brewers reacted to Brooklyn Crowd sake. So please stay with us.
Bob's Red Mill has been milling whole grains since 1978. One of the nice things about Bob's Red Mill is it's the only, that I know of, national supplier that's easily available for lots of interesting, hard-to-get grains and other seed products. So, you know, before Bob's Red Mill became widely available, you couldn't go get something like quinoa very easily, or you couldn't go get spelt easily in small quantities. But now you go to any one of the huge number of stores that carry Bob's Red Mill, and you can get smaller amounts of these really interesting, fun things to play with. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guests today are Brandon Dong and Brian Pollan, co-owners of Brooklyn Kura, the very first sake brewery in New York, which opened this fall. So what is your production capacity?
So we're discovering that on a daily basis. I mean, we have a plan, capacity, and it's north of 300 koku, so let's say north of 80,000 bottles a year. But it's something we're discovering as we test our new equipment and as we kind of produce our first scale batches. We'll have a better sense.
That's great, because I you're saying you wanted to explore many different kinds, right? So rather than three types that you're launching at the beginning.
Yep.
So if you have capacity and you have a nice space too, so you can do a lot of different new exploration of flavors.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, and so where are you planning to distribute your sake?
So we are, I mean, one of our primary focus is introducing people to the sake in our tap room, but we are interested in on and off premise with a focus on New York City to begin with. So there'll be restaurants, liquor stores, wine shops that we'll be connecting with and have already established some relationships with to get our sake out.
Right, that'd be awesome. I mean, you're going to be targeting Japanese restaurants, or could be anything?
So I think our goal is to broaden the set of places that carry sake. So we will, of course, be working with Japanese restaurants. They've been incredibly supportive in this whole effort as both kind of educated tasters, providing us feedback and kind of guiding us through the network here in New York City. But I don't think it would be success for us if we're not putting our sake in non-Japanese restaurants. Again, our ultimate goal is to expand the footprint of sake in the U.S. and starting in New York, and it will be, that's an essential thing.
Okay, right. So I personally keep hearing, do you know this Brooklyn Crowd? It's just a new place, and do you know when it's opening? So there are many people waiting for you guys to start distributing.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah, and I heard that over 10 Japanese sake breweries visited you. So what are their reactions to your business and sake?
The reaction we've gotten from Japan has just been overwhelmingly positive. They're very excited. I think that, some markets of sake have been on the decline in Japan. So they really, and also I think it's considered like your grandfather's drink in Japan, and the young people are drinking craft beer and craft whiskey. So I think they really want to show that, like, hey, this is a craft scene in the United States. Like, I think they want to show some of the Brooklyn cool back in Japan, and so they've been very encouraging. And they came out and tasted some of our first sort of practice sakes, and they had good things to say about it. They had constructive criticism. We've met a bunch of people where I can, you know, email or call up and discuss some of the technical details of brewing, and they're all just very generous with information. It's been fantastic.
That's great. Yeah, rather than just try to compete and they expand at the bigger pie.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. I mean, and I think the Nambu Bijin event is a indication. I mean, we want to do launches for any new kind of sake coming onto the scene in our space. And I mean, the whole community needs to kind of work together in order to grow the pie.
Great. So keep me posted.
Of course.
Yeah, we want to, you know, like, we want to support you guys. And I think it's, the reason I keep hearing about Brooklyn Sake from little Japanese people, they really expect you to do something fun and high quality thing. So, and speaking of, so I heard that I think before the show that you have a mixed feeling about making Japanese sake as an American. So maybe could you tell us about it?
I wouldn't say mixed feelings. We're trying to sort of walk a fine line of, I mean, sake is Japan's national drink. You know, we want to learn as much as we can about it and be respectful of it, but we're not Japanese. I haven't studied for 10 years under a toji. I don't refer to myself as a toji. I'm a brewer. So we're not claiming to be making traditional Japanese sake in the United States. We want to learn as much as we can, and we want to do it here in the United States. I think sometimes America can take things from other cultures and really mess them up. But occasionally, you know, like we took beer from largely Germany, and now you can find a really great American IPA anywhere in the world. Mm. Wine, you know, was ignored for years until people took it seriously in from France in California, and now, you know, there's fantastic American wines. So, and some of the best whiskey in the world now is Japanese. So,
Thank you, Scotland. We took it from Scotland, right?
So, you know, with that in mind, we want to take what we can learn and just see what happens in the United States.
Mm. I think globally, in the culinary world, everything's becoming more local, sustainable. Mm-hmm. And I think this whole Japanese sake in Brooklyn really fits in that picture as well.
Yeah.
So I think it's really great thing that you guys are doing it. And otherwise, you know, the tradition gets stuck. You know, just and not to mention the sake consumption is declining in Japan, and then they die because there's nobody succeeding.
Yeah, I mean, what people from Japan have told me is that the tradition is so strong that for someone to make a change, that it typically, that needs to happen over many years if you want to change the direction of it. I think if, you know, for better or worse, in the United States, we, you know, somebody can just change something the next day and take something in a totally different direction. So we don't want to get too wild, but...
Right. Well, also, I think realistically, like, you know, say sushi or kaiseki chefs, they didn't have resources. And we have internet. Like, click away, you can get any kind of scientific analysis. Why you have to do this that way? What's the reason not to use them? So it all makes sense. Yep. And I think Japanese traditional industry understands that too. Mm-hmm. So, okay. And by the way, by yourself, how do you describe your sake? The flavor and taste?
So I mean, the way I describe it, and in simple terms, is... we see our sake as perfectly substitutable for a fine wine that you would pair with dinner. It's light, it's floral, it's crisp, it's drinkable. Our alcohol by volume range is around 14 to 16%, but they're very subtle, complex flavors that we've been able to get out of both American rice, Brooklyn water, and the koji that we've been making. And so we've had sakes that we've produced that have ranged from having like a really strong ripe banana and mesquite quality to them to a much more kind of traditional where you can smell and taste the apple and strawberry qualities that some of the yeast yield. So we've been very lucky. Again, it's all subtle, light, crisp, and to be enjoyed with anything you want to eat with it.
Right, yeah. And I got lucky last time I visited you. I had the trial version. And so at the beginning, I like the minerality. It's so soft, but it's still there. Mm. So you have some accent. And then at the beginning, the floral sweetness, and it disappears with a dry finish. Mm. It's a very ephemeral. I don't think you should call it a substitute. Oh. Yeah, or anything else that's very unique.
And it's good for us to hear from other people because, like, I mean, Brian and I have worked together every day for a year and a half, and we've been with our sake, so it's easy for us to get in a bubble, and that's, you know, so we're really looking forward to the tap room being fully open, so we can get that kind of feedback.
Exactly.
Mm. Right. Okay. So. So you have a very beautiful tap room, as you mentioned. It's very spacious too. So how are you going to use such an attractive space?
So it is meant for the New York City sake community, for the Japanese sake community, as a place for us to introduce our products and receive feedback, like we just discussed, from the range of different people who want to consume sake. It's essentially that. We are going to be able to be more experimental there with smaller batches, which we're super excited about. And it's a place to kind of bring people to the diverse network of kind of maker, like retailers and industry city, so they can kind of get a sense of all the things exciting that are going on there, in addition to what we're doing.
And also, had you planning to have host events by Japanese sake breweries?
Exactly. So the Nambu Bijin event is an example of that. We hope to kind of be a home in New York for Japanese sake brewery.
I think it's really hard for Japanese traditional sake breweries come to New York, and then they can go to trade shows like Javits Center, but what else? They have to go to Japanese restaurants, and it's a big deal. I have to order food. And so I think your space is really ideal for them.
And we also hope to, if there are people who want to teach classes on sake or, train sommeliers, they can actually come and see exactly the process of it happening instead of just reading or listening about it.
Okay. So I heard that this is a slight diversion from what we've been talking about. I heard that there are about 15 artisanal sake breweries in the U.S. by American people. So what do you think about their sake?
It has the feeling that it's becoming a thing. There's maybe 15, 16, 17, typically 1-3 person, operations. There's a saying in Japanese that there's 10,000 ways to make sake. I think that's totally true, in the United States as well. It's a range of people who have lived in Japan for a long time, who speak and read Japanese fluently, and are using like very traditional methods, and then there's some people that are doing some pretty wild stuff with sake. I'm making an effort to taste everybody's go around and taste everybody's sake, but I think that we're sort of middle of the road of everybody that's out there as far as approach.
So what wild means, different types of yeast.
In different processes. There's people who've been brewing beer, and so they bring sort of a beer making techniques to sake.
Huh, interesting.
So it's going to be interesting to see over the next few years, like how all of this kind of gets going, and if sort of like a style of American sake rises up out of all of this.
Maybe you can host a sake conference for sake producers.
It's been a delicious exercise, so we get to try all these things.
But you mentioned it could be 1-3 people running a sake brewery. You can't sleep.
Yeah,
that's crazy. Wow, I really admire those people.
I went from a life of like writing in a laboratory notebook to straight up physical labor. I've always heard that, it's like if you watch and you like documentaries on traditional Japanese sake, they're up at 5 in the morning, and it's like backbreaking work. And it's like physically challenging. It's 75% of sake making is cleaning.
Well, I think it's really important because, the yeast and the molds that you're dealing with, they can't have extra.
It's a very delicate beverage. Like, in beer, you add hops, which is antimicrobial, and you boil it. So you've killed all the bugs.
Right.
Rice is steamed, but then it goes into a cold vat of water and there's open fermentation. So it's not in a closed, sealed vessel. So you have to take care to, change your shoes when you go into the tank room and things like that.
Wow. Well, good luck. I really hope you can sleep well, right? Do you communicate with all those other American sake breweries?
Yeah, we pretty much know each other now, and it's a fantastic supportive community. It's interesting to see how people are kind of like when they can't get equipment, what they're doing to get the process done that they need to get done. We're all very supportive of each other. There's some people like I started talking to 2-3 years ago that started giving me advice that gave me contacts for different manufacturers of equipment. And on the other side, we're trying to pay that forward. We've had people who've heard about us and and they are want to start a sake brewery in Hawaii. So, you know, we like I'll answer any question anybody emails or if they want to start a sake brewery and just continue all the help that we got and put it back out into the community.
Right, and to grow together.
Yep.
Right. Wow, that's amazing. So I can't wait to see the future of American sake. Seriously. Right. So what's your plan for the future?
So we stay pretty focused on the near term because we got to get open and sell in sake. But the reality is we want to make the best sake we can. And I think we go back to the same themes, right? We want to make the best sake we can. We want to expand kind of the consumer base of sake in the U.S. And we want to kind of share our excitement with something that like we fell in love with in 2013 and worked hard to put ourselves in a position to share with New York City and more broadly.
Right. Well, I just came up to mind. So I think one of the New Zealand sake breweries, which happened to use the Carlos Rice, won like a really good prize international competition. So you never know what's going to happen.
you never know.
Yeah, maybe I should get your order right now. Okay, so where can we find more information about Brooklyn Cora?
So our website, www.brooklyncora.com, is something we try and keep pretty current. Instagram is a great place to keep track of us. If you were on today, you got to see that we got a press.
Right. Okay, so it's Brooklyn Cora, that's KURA.com.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. All right, so thank you for joining us today, and good luck with everything.
Thanks so much for having us.
Seriously, it was a pleasure.
Right, so hopefully you can come back and talk about more progress.
We'd love to.
Right.
Exactly.
All right. So thank you. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japaneseatheheritageradionetwork.org. And actually, I'm getting a request, and I think next season more topics are reflected by your requests. So thank you so much. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org and iTunes and Stitcher as a podcast. So please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. We'd appreciate your feedback. And our engineer today is Vitor Harsh. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.